Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. American painter, printmaker, and sculptor Oliver Lee Jackson, born 1935, has created a complex body of work which masterfully weaves together visual influences ranging from the Renaissance to modernism, with principles of rhythm and improvisation drawn from his study of African cultures and American jazz. In a paired talk on May 19, 2019, at the National Gallery of Art, Paul Carter Harrison and Quincy Troop, both writers and friends of Jackson, discussed their parallel pursuits of new avenues for creative thought and action. Harrison shared anecdotes from late-night studio discussions with Jackson, along with explanations of Jackson's understanding of how his heritage factors into his work. Troop read from his poetry and talked about the social and artistic environment in St. Louis, Missouri, that produced jazz musicians Miles Davis and Julius Hemphill, as well as the Black Arts Group that supported Jackson's early work.
Good afternoon. Thank you for coming in on this beautiful spring day in Washington. I'm Harry Cooper, curator of modern art here at the National Gallery, and more to the point, for today, I'm the curator of Oliver Jackson recent paintings upstairs in the East Building. Has everybody had a look at it? Yes. Okay. And we have the artist here, and we're very proud to welcome him back. Stand up and say hello to everybody. Yes. And he's coming back again. The show runs until September 15th. And on September 15th at 2 p.m., Mr. Jackson and I will have a conversation here. Also, the previous day, it looks like we're going to be able to screen a new documentary on the Black Artist Group of St. Louis, which will be a premiere. So that'll be on September 14th. Today, in the middle of the show, so to speak, we've got a wonderful event with two very distinguished authors. And I will introduce Paul Carter Harrison first, who is on my left. Paul is an award-winning playwright, director, and theorist. His work has been produced and published here and abroad. He's been long associated with the Negro Ensemble Company, which produced his early plays, Top Hat, Abercrombie Apocalypse, and The Great McDaddy, which received an Obie Award. Other plays included Americane Gothic, Death of Boogie Woogie, Tabernacle. He also helped develop such shows as Melvin Van Peebles' Ain't Supposed to Die a Natural Death, Aisha Rahman's Lady Day, Larry Neal's In an Upstate Motel, Ben Tyler's Sweet Thunder, The Billy Strayhorn Story. He has won many awards. I won't list all of them, if that's okay. And he retired in 2002 from professorship at Columbia College Chicago after 27 years. He resides in Panama and serves as visiting scholar at Emory University, where he guides a research project on critical vocabulary for African diasporic expressivity. So Paul has some readings and clips and images for us and for about half an hour, and he will be followed by Quincy Troop. And I just want to do the pre-introduction of Mr. Troop, who is an equally distinguished writer, poet, critic, biographer, including of the great trumpeter Miles Davis. So I'm going to get out of the way, and Paul Carter Harrison.
Thank you. Can you hear me? Yeah, hello. Thank you. It is my great pleasure to be here in the esteemed company of Oliver and Quincy, and hopefully you take away something that's you might not have known before. And by all means, we will encourage you to go and take a closer look at the work that's being presented here at the museum. This is an extensive paper, which I'm not going to read all of it, just a little bit of it. But it's actually something I published with Quincy's very distinguished magazine, Black Renaissance Noir. It's a journal, not just a magazine. It's a journal, quarterly. And I published it once before. It's called Aesthetics of Beauty in an Africana Mode. So I've taken some sections out of this. I've accepted some sections that I thought might be appropriate for this occasion. Let me just start here with, we could play the music if you like. Okay. Walking in the studio home of Oliver Lee Jackson is always a blast. One never knows what the soundscape will be. Right now, for example, we're listening to Julius Hemphill, who's had an enormous influence on many of us over since the 70s. My initial encounter, my initial encounter with Oliver was at the airport when I directed at the airport when he was coming to pick me up at Sacramento where I was going to go and teach. And he came to pick me up. And as he arrived there, I get off with a bunch of bags from New York. And here are these professor guys come to me, introduce themselves. I said, good, my bags are right over there. And Oliver looked at me quizzically. My bags are right over there. And then I said, yes. Well, he said, no more. You know, he did challenge it. He laughed, he chuckled, picked up my bags, there are a number of them, put them in his car and drove me home to his house. Had some music. As soon as I got there, this is when I started having my experience with Oliver Jackson and Julius Hemphill. He picked up these bags, took me to the house, put on some white beans, and we had plenty of wine, and played Julius Hemphill specifically Dogon AD. This is his first major album. And he's played this piece, and I was mesmerized. But I was also equally mesmerized by watching Oliver work on a very important series of paintings, one of the paintings, from the Sharpsville series. Now, this painting was curious, because I watched him work on this piece for a whole year. Every day, very meticulously putting this felt materials together, a kind of an applique, but it's not an applique. It's just actually developing a whole force field, a whole energy field, with sewing on these pieces of cloth. And I was astonished when I was looking at this painting and listening to Julius Hemphill. So that was my introduction to both Oliver and Julius that very same day. So the entire afternoon we went about that work, that introduction between us, and also finding out something about the St. Louis Black Arts Group, which I had not known about before I got there. I also discovered something else that became a very vital part of the journey, you might say. I discovered that the recording of Dogon AD was made possible by a St. Louis dental surgeon who was a supporter of Black Arts Group in St. Louis. I said, who could that be? But the only practicing black dental surgeon I knew in St. Louis with the evolved sensibility and desire to support the creative black ideas was Donald Suggs, my erstwhile schoolmate at Indiana University, whose cultural curiosity guided him toward an informed inquiries in architecture, art, and all forms of music. Classical, but mostly so-called jazz. The very presence of Suggs, who was completing his medical school while I, a transfer student from New York, was completing my BA requirements, it kind of took away, it deflected my feeling of being a hostage to the cornfields. We were able to see a lot of each other because he was a very close friend of my roommate, Freddie Wilson, And they would come over. I mean, Freddie would come over all the time. Donald would come over to our place frequently to look at the studio work of Freddie, a student. If he saw something he liked, he bought it on the spot. This was quite something I had never heard of. I never heard of a black person buying a painting. They've received paintings. I didn't know that. The only black paintings I saw on the walls of most people were, usually out of Macy's. You know, kind of a, some kind of a, okay. If it wasn't from Macy's, it would be from some other curious sources. But they were not being purchased. That improved by the 70s. I was very happy to see that. By the 70s, there were just a great wide range of opportunities to buy from black collectors, people who were literally paying for artwork. Donald was the first person I had ever seen do that. And there it was. Suddenly, by the 1970s, it was happening. And this is... Sorry? Yes, you can hear. That's another part of the Sharpsville series. Donald, please stand up. You're in the house. And this was the beginning of something that was quite remarkable, which we'll talk about a little bit. I thought I was directing this. You're directing it? Okay.
I'm the director.
Okay. So Suggs would come and do that, and we began to see, I used to see posters from black art shows in my more well-bred black friends. But I had white friends who were buying, whose parents were buying paintings. Somehow I accepted that. That's the way it goes. We don't buy them. We get gifts of them and that kind of thing. But that changed, and I was very happy to see that by the 1970s. But Donald was exceptional. His personal interest in all forms of artistic achievement was a passion, quite unlike a wealthy black entrepreneur in Chicago who, while negotiating the purchase of an Ed Clark painting, let it be known that the price for the large canvas was not an issue. Her only concern was would it be compatible over her newly purchased couch. It's probably not, it's not necessarily, it says something that only black people do. A lot of people go spend $1 million to put over a couch without paying attention to what the artwork is. When we graduated in 1957, Suggs did his medical internship in St. Louis, and I, having abandoned any interest in behavioral psychology, returned to New York to do graduate studies at the New School in phenomenology and gestalt psychology. But I asked, how would you get over there? Well, I got tired of behavioral sciences. I wanted to take a look at more philosophical, spiritual stuff that awakened my appetite for making ideas and writing and that sort of thing. When I finished my studies, I went off to live in Europe in 62 to absorb myself in writing and directing in the theater, and did not return until 1968 to teach at Howard University. And this is where my studies came in. I came to Howard with my first full-length play in tow, Tabernacle, a play within a play, mowed like a black church, the audience used as congregation, with 20 black male actors, a work that would be produced in that could not be produced in Amsterdam because the paucity of black personnel. Also, a lot of the black personnel that were there did not have the sense of urgency. They were so culturally, socially separated from the conditions that we were going through in that period, late 60s. You know, the Dutch citizens, and that was all there was to that. So they did not participate in our movement. The production required, and mind you, I said all black. The production required an uncluttered, open space to aid the dramatic tension, a practice I had learned in Europe where visual artists rather than set designers collaborated intimately with directors in the production process to animate the environment. Thus, in addition to being assured of having an all-black cast with an urgent sense of empathy with the social urgencies of the dramatic event, I was able to put the entire physical production in the hands of visual artists. Sculptor Ed Love and his two students, Joyce Owens and Akili Ron Anderson, treated the space like a canvas to set a performance mode conceived with archetypical characterizations that included a preacher as the principal orchestrator of the mode, a chorus of mothers consisting of 5 6-foot tall husky men wearing oversized masks that were beautiful in their grotesquerie. A Coltrane-inspired musical ensemble led by Eric Gravatt, at that time a philosophy student, which improvised through improvisational music, advanced all the actions. So I was in a learning curve about my way of work, getting away from the usual conventions. And that's what finally led me to Oliver Jackson. In 1970, responding to the insistent solicitation of a vibrant group of black students in search of guidance in the theater department at Department of State University of California, Sacramento, among them being the potent leadership of a robust young actor, Randy Martin, an uncompromising actress frequently who appears on television today, and of course the very sterling ritual stylist stage director, Shirley Jo Finney, I left Howard with a collection of poems by Melvin Van Peebles and discovered Oliver Jackson among the new faculty. And so I arrived in the orbit of Oliver Lee, eating white beans, drinking white wine, and absorbed in his particular way of approach to thinking about visual images. Jackson arranged for me to secure an apartment in his complex, but it would not be ready for a week. He invited me to stay at his apartment until it was ready. He was interested in my new book, The Drama of Nomo, the manuscript in the final stages of completion. With utter confidence, I initiated my discourse. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. That is how I began. An acknowledgement of power of word force, which antedated as early as 3200 BC by the Dogon of West African nation, Mali, who recognized that the word otherwise nomo, however insinuated, spoken, gestured, or signed, was a spiritual vector for the transformation of thing. The Dogon people's version of the word is the nomo. The Yoruba might refer to it as ashe, the creative force that gives form to all things. The benefits of nomo are received primarily through the dynamics of a specific secular or sacred ritual that promotes a cosmic bonding with the spiritual energy stored in the ancestral memory. The source of ashe that guides the imagination for the release of aesthetic objectives that Robert Ferris Thompson refers to as flash of the spirit. In the corporal world, word force becomes manifest as procreative essence of spirit. In the creative process of making, that is, weaving, carving, oratory, song, dance, and drum. In the construction of a particularized aesthetic, we recognize word in the creative process of wood carvings, quilting, weaving, oratory, performance instruments, or song and dance, and even the kinesthetic angularity that drives improvisational mode of vibrant colors and irregular patterns of cloth that signing texts such as in the crossing patterns of the Ashanti Kente cloth, etc. The word of power or ashe as life force, however, is diminished without rhythm. Of course, African cultures are not the only beneficiaries of rhythm in the construction of art production, as we clearly could witness in the calligraphic artwork of Asia, or in some of the large, or the august scale of staging of Wagner, a Ring Cycle. Oliver found my discourse impressive, even engaging, but entirely flawed. The more I talked about this near-complete project, the more intense became his inquiry, raising more questions than I had answers. In the first 2 days of friendly inquiry, Jackson would go to his prodigious library of African and European mythology, Eastern and African sacred systems, African-American slave narratives, and more. It became apparent that the book was not ready for publication. The rest of the week, over daily plates of white beans and consumption of much wine, Jackson mentored me through a clear exegesis of my discourse. At the end of the week, I called my publisher in New York and told him that the book was not ready, but I would need at least a year to rewrite it, and I did. The book, which proposed that the African-American expressivity was a manifestation of the aesthetics located in the African continuum, was received by scholars and practitioners centered around African-centered work with much enthusiasm. The intimacy of that period of peer mentoring sealed a bond that has been uninterrupted for 50 years. I'm surprised to be saying that today. But it's been 50 years, Oliver, since we started this process. Our initial collaboration, excuse me, our initial collaboration was the conceptualization and development of Van Peebles' poem collection of narrative poems, Ain't Supposed to Die a Natural Death, which we ritualized and transformed into a theatrical mode. Oliver's stark, unadorned environment of wood and metal was invaluable in the creation of an open field of experience, a ritual space that permitted the actors to achieve characters that were not subordinated to familiar tropes. We worked intimately with the students for 15 hours a week. 15 hours a week. A collective commitment that accorded us time to process the new performance concept of modality, so as to avoid presenting the poems as a parade of familiar black erotic types performing slices of life recitations, as was the case later on Broadway. Instead, each active student freed from the Stanislavski method of the training was responsible for the improvisational internalization of archetypical characterizations that could reliably reveal a mode of oppression without reducing the characters to caricature. Spirited, if you're following me on this, you still following me? It's not yet flawed. All right. That's good. Spirited by the syncopated dirge of a local band, the characters moved continuously through the open angular space, which included scaffolding that extended into the audience that became a community aspect of the total mold. While there was a trajectory toward a final action in the ritual, the open space was to sustain a mode of spontaneity that was seething with apparently disconnected actions and a cacophony of conversations that became muted but not hushed when a character testimony was being delivered, each individualized testimony derived from a life moment constructed by the cast. At the close of the ritual, The audience had become intimately locked into the mode and shared the collective epiphany and how difficult it is to die a natural death in a mode of oppression. It was a thing of beauty, a rarefied quality that eludes ordinary things and persons without an aesthetic process that is like poetry, a distillation of excess to invoke the power of God. We would call the theatrical style Kuntu drama, which Jackson elucidated in the preface of my anthology, Kuntu Drama, Plays of the African Continuum. Jackson notes, Kuntu drama is theater that has as its ultimate purpose to reveal and to invoke the reality of the particular mode it has ritualized. The theater style depends on power and power invocation. It attempts to produce modification in behavior through a combined use of word power, dance, and music power. It is sacred theater in the sense that it seeks to fulfill a spiritual revelation. The play is the ritualized context of reality. The ritual confirms. The ritual confirms the mode. It is a living incantation that forces and releases through invocation, beneficent power for the audience. Kuntu drama is testimonial. let me move on here. Through Oliver's intercession, I was reunited with Suggs. And upon visiting his home in St. Louis, I was overwhelmed mostly by his collection, I'm talking about Suggs's collection, of contemporary Black and European artists, objects d'art from Africa and Asia, and particularly moved by the large four canvases of Jackson that occupied all four walls of a large room, without other objects in the bare space, not even a chair. You can put on there. Yeah, that's good. You're good. This, by the way, is part of the Sharpsville series. I think some of you still remember Sharpsville. And I'm showing you some of these images because these go way back. And you can see that they're not. Oliver didn't just discover this process he's been working on. The last 15 years. It's 15 years you're doing. It does go back quite a number of years. We're talking about the 70s, most of these images I'm showing you. On one occasion, Suggs and I shared the bond with Oliver. Two of us flying around the country to support Jackson's exhibitions or simply to catch up at his studio for a few days of highbrow, low loin boy talk. On one occasion, in the late 80s, Jackson had two major exhibitions, one in New York, the other in Boston. A few days after the New York exhibit, we decided to drive up to Boston with my soon-to-be bride, Wanda. I don't know if we could see her painting next, but it will come up soon. Well, here's the boys. Let's look at the boys for a minute, and we'll come back. We decided to drive up to Boston with Wanda. It was an early day exhibit, so we decided to drive up. We weren't sure when we were going to go back. So we did not book a hotel. If it became too late, we would do that. Gallery owner in Boston, however, had a party early in the day, and the party went on until 1 o'clock in the morning, and we had no booking. So we had to do something. Oliver says, let's drive back. He wasn't going to do any driving. It would be me doing the driving, because as soon as Donald hit the back seat, he was gone into one of those medical practices, habits that the doctors have. They do a cat nap straight away. He didn't waste more than 30 seconds, but he went right to sleep. For the next 4 hours, I was driving back to New York. And what we got, much to the fascination of my soon-to-be wife, Oliver went into a performance. Excuse me. Oliver had gone into a performance, a tour de force, as a matter of fact. Without missing a beat, he started with Confirmation, whistling Charlie Parker's Confirmation. Perfect pitch, whistling. He went through Charlie Parker, and without missing a beat, he launched into descriptions of the Kansas City jazz scene, followed by the great migration of blacks from the South to the Midwest, discussed Marxist Revolution and Marcus Garvey. He sang a Dead Belly song, extrapolated Zen philosophy versus African sacred systems, vilified the contemptible Bledsoe from The Invisible Man, from Ellison's Invisible Man, recited and celebrated the poetry of Melvin Tolson, elucidated Tutuola's Palm Wine Drinkers, mimicked Johnny Hartman singing a Coltrane tune, an entire panoply of performance sources, which he performed nonstop till Donald awoke suddenly as we reached New York at dawn. And a grand performance was had, I mean, was produced by all of that. In 1998, Oliver had visited Madrid with his exhibition of paintings. In an interview with Maria Sentis, he was quoted, he was asked, what path has African art taken through African-American artists? Jackson immediately shifted the parameters of the conversation away from African art as the benchmark for discussion to African sensibility, noting that while there was no verifiable path to African art, to art American expressivity, an active sensibility was clearly discernible in a vital African continuum that does not depend on African art, objects, that is, and artifacts. Jackson identified certain modes of living, such as adornment, style, mannerism, sacred thought, culinary and syntactical patterns of speech that reflect the active linkages, not necessarily to African art, but to the origin of African sensibility that continues to resonate African diasporians throughout the world. It is, then, the African sensibility that guides the transformative process of making art. Though expressive transformation is not unique only to the people of African descent, for the African diasporic artists, those from African America, African Caribbean, African Brazil, it's a primary goal thrust in making, which is an important thing, making critical for making the success of the thing made. In other words, it is a thing that has to be worked on. I tell, for example, very frequently I have to remind people when they tell me, I got to go home at 6 o'clock and do my art. I say, what do you mean you're doing your art? Is that not work? What you really meant to say is, I got to go home and do my work, or at very least, or nothing more than, I got to do my artwork. But to say I'm going to do my art, you know, I got to write a poem, is work. To write a tune is work. It might come off expressively as art, but it is work. Am I getting lengthy? You're going to cut me off. The director is going to... You can't win these battles. But in any case, I want to just give you kind of an entry into Oliver as a person, as well as some of the ideas that he and I have been involved in for all these 50 years, as well as Donald Suggs. We've had these conversations on and on and on for 50 years. And I'm just astonished by the thought of it. But I wanted to share that with you. It's very important. I, by the way, met Quincy in 1968, the very first year that I arrived from Europe. He came to visit Howard. We met and, you know, remained friends also 50 years. I said, it's very interesting that some of us are still walking around here, Quincy. Okay. Okay, I hope this has been illuminating, and I'm going to continue to pass this on to, I think we might have some time for questions later, pass it on to Quincy Troop.
Thank you so much. So, briefly, it's hard to be brief with these introductions of such distinguished guests. Quincy Troop is the author of 20 books, 10 volumes of poetry, and 3 children's books among them, many awards. He has several recent books of poetry, Seduction, Ghost Voices, and Errancities. He is writing a novel, The Legacy of Charlie Footman, and working on a memoir, The Accordion Years. Maybe best known as co-author with Miles Davis of Miles, the Autobiography, also Earl the Pearl with Earl Monroe, The Pursuit of Happiness with Chris Gardner, editor of James Baldwin, The Legacy, co-editor of Giant Talk, an anthology of third world literature, author of Miles and Me, a chronicle of his friendship with Miles Davis, which will, I understand, become a major motion picture in about a year. He is professor emeritus from University of California, San Diego. As Paul mentioned, he edits Black Renaissance Noir, a quarterly journal published by NYU. Lives in Harlem with his wife, who is right here, Margaret Porter Troop. So, Quincy, it's all yours.
Thank you. Happy to be here. I just want to give a brief talk about I'm from St. Louis also, and I didn't know Oliver Jackson when I was growing up, but although I did know of him, like he knew of me and my family in St. Louis because we were notorious people. And we don't have to go further than that, you know, but, you know, about why we were notorious. But we knew of each other in a way. And so when I started teaching at Ohio University, I went to teach at Ohio University, and we went up to Oberlin. Somebody said, let's go up to Oberlin. So Oliver Jackson was teaching there. And that's where I really got to meet Oliver Jackson in his studio. I'd already met Don Suggs. I knew him, and he and Jackson and another poet named Eugene Redmond were teaching at Oberlin. And when I went into his studio for the first time, this was, I don't know, in the early 70s or something, and I was fascinated because he had this fetus in a jar, you know. So I used to always be looking at this fetus without even looking at his paintings. I was like, wow, a fetus in a jar, you know. And everybody who I knew that went to Oliver's studio used to talk about the fetus in the jar. You know what I mean? It was peculiar, but we wouldn't say nothing about it. You know, why he had a fetus in the jar. Maybe a weird kind of thought process. It was about a drawing and all that, and I realized that later. So that's how I met Oliver Jackson. I wanted to put that out there first and about how I met him. And we became friends then. We've been friends to this day. We kind of, you know, with Paul, and we got a whole great... Dr. Suggs, Donald Suggs, and we've all been friends, and it's been a close-knit group of people. But I want to start by, so I want to give him that, and I'm thankful that he had this show, and this is the reason we're here. But I wrote a poem for him, and because I'm a poet, I'm going to start with that. And this is we used to go to a place in Berkeley. Every time I'd go to California, Oliver, myself, Mildred Howard, and a whole bunch of us would go to this place called Skates in Berkeley. And it was right on the bay, and it was beautiful just looking out over it. The view from Skates in Berkeley for Oliver Jackson, homeboy and painter. The clouds were mountains that day, behind the real mountains, sideways. From San Francisco, across the Toss Bay, the beauty we saw from Skates in Berkeley was real there, stretched out behind sailboats, the wind-driven waves bucking, like rodeo horses carrying cowboys, breaking across the foaming gray water like sand dunes, rippling across an empty expanse of desert, mirrored and beautiful. Here, near sunset, we looked out through the wide open windows and took in the view. Unbroken from here, under sinking sunlight, the hills breast, the gulls resembling small planes banked over waves, searching for fish they snapped up in their beaks, under fleecing clouds, streaming up high, crossing the jet stream. The prickling mist hung low over Angel Island like the day after too many drinks fogged up your head. In an afternoon sunlight, on a day further back in cobwebs than you care to remember, but there anyway, as a still life you clung to once, deep in long-gone memory, the skyline changing now behind the tumbling clouds, the architecture trembling through the mist of the shining pearl by the bay, grown up from split-open gums of the land like chipped shark teeth or tombstones leaning white and bright into the light, shimmering like the friendship of this meeting is shimmering here, because we knew we were what we always thought we were, homeboys on top of our games, yeah, laughing like joyous paint in sprayed mist. The fog overhead hung low over Oakland, thick as a mattress where you laid down your head full of dreams and painted images in full view of the Bay Bridge, stretching like one of your elegant lines through our view. Here, outside Skate's window, the sun plunging like one of your painted faces into rabid wash of gray waves, the wind slapping salt tears across our faces, creased as the American flag is streaked with a rainbow of colors here, where we were what we always thought we were. Yes, on this day, when the moment heaved up the waves surging like our dreams, and we were riding those bucking horse waves, breaking across the dune-kicking waters. Yes, mirrored and beautiful, we were strong as we always knew we would be. Our view unbroken from here. In Skates, under the dazzling sunlight of our dreams, streaming across the jet stream, high up in the turbulent afternoon of our heads, light and luminous. We were homeboys, Oliver, yes, homeboys, on this rare, shimmering day filled with flight. Yes, homeboys, Oliver, on this rare, shimmering day filled with light. I got these pieces on, critical pieces on Miles Davis and Oliver, and he's in it. But I want to begin this because of the fact that I think it's connected to this whole idea of modal, the modal way of writing. And for me, poetry. So that's what I'm going to do today as a poet. I'm going to try to talk about the modal modes that we write, I write in, you know what I mean? So, and I want to start by beginning by quoting from an essay I wrote titled, From Kinda Blue to Bitches Brew. What I was doing in this essay, I was talking about Miles Davis's music. You know, I was talking about his music, all of the kind of music, because he was one of the ones who kind of created, in a way, he and Russell, the whole idea of the modal way of music. And so I say here, I'm talking here, and let me get it together. On Milestones. Milestones on the recording, Miles Davis on the recording Milestones, released in 1958, begins for the first time to write and play in the modal form, which he explained in our book, Miles, the Autobiography, as seven notes off each note, a scale off each note, a minor note. He went on to say that he found out that music played in this way didn't lock the musician or music in, that the music could go on seemingly forever, that musicians didn't have to worry about traditional changes, that he could do more with a musical line. He added that the challenge for him when he worked in the modal way was to see how inventive he could become melodically. Again, in our book, he said, it's not like when you base stuff off on cards and you know at the end of 32 bars that the cards have run out and there's nothing to do but repeat what you've done with variations. I, meaning Miles, I was moving away from that way of playing, he goes on, and into more melodic ways. Miles extended this modal approach to music in his landmark album, Kind of Blue, doing things, and he kept moving forward after that. But I want to go back a little bit, because before he could do that, he said Miles had gotten into thinking modally about music after attending a performance of the Ballet Africain from Guinea in 1957 with his first wife, Frances Taylor Davis, who was a great dancer. It was the rhythm of the dancers and the African finger piano that, according to him, fucked him up, blew his mind. The drummers, the time signatures that they played again, the rhythms in 5-4, 6-8, and 4-4 that were always changing and popping, and it seemed like they could go on dancing and playing forever because of the open form that they were in. He said he knew he couldn't copy what they were doing because they were African, and he wasn't. He hadn't lived their interior experience, but he could do something that would embrace that feeling that he got when he saw them dance and heard them play. And that something would be a concept that he and George Russell, another fine musician and composer, would call the modal way, in which Miles continued in his new album, landmark album, Kind of Blue. You know, so I think it's interesting that he was talking about this. He went back to Africa and he was talking about changing up the music. And I think that artists, dancers, whether they be dancers or playwrights or painters like Oliver, are always thinking about not only painting what they know, but always trying to go someplace else with it. I know I am when I write poetry. I've been always trying to go someplace else than where I've been. Because I think that's the way forward. You know, we are not, you know, people talk about us being, we are not Europeans. We are Americans, you know? And, you know, when I'm talking about poetry, I can write haikus. I can write tankas. I can write ballads. I can write odes. I can write sestinas. I can write villanelles. But they're European forms. What I've always been interested in being a poet in the United States is freeing up that and breaking away and us creating our own forms here. We have to be confident that we can do that. And sometimes it doesn't hit people right away, but I've been always trying to do things that have been rooted here in the United States, you know? So I think with that, I'm gonna read you a couple of things. I grew up in the Baptist church. I'll give you some examples of what I'm talking about. I grew up in the Baptist church. My grandmother took me to kicking and screaming, took me to church every Sunday, and I sang in the choir. I had to go to church all day long on Sunday. That's why I stopped when I was 13. I refused to go anymore. You know, I refused to go anymore, and she threatened to beat me up and all that. I didn't care. I'd rather take a beating than go back there. You know, I didn't want to go back, you know, because I had heard everything, you know. And when you go to church all day on a Sunday, Sunday school, morning service, then you come back and eat dinner, then go back there, go BTU, all of that, and you got to listen to that. And you look at the black women in the church when they and on Sunday, when they faint, they would always, somebody always caught them. You know, when they fall back like this, somebody would catch them. I used to always let them hit the floor. You know, I want to see some improvisation up here. How come somebody's always behind them? You know what I mean? I mean, how do they know to be there, to catch them? You know what I mean? That's what I always want to know. I got smacked because I asked my grandmother's friend. My grandmother was president of the flower club. And her friend was always there to catch them. somebody when they faint. Oh, boom. See, pop. So I said, how are you catching everybody? And she left a handprint on my face. Smacked the shit out of me. You know what I mean? So they didn't really want to talk about it. You know what I mean? What it was. It was a performance. That's what it was. So I stopped going at 13. And I would go and play basketball. That's what I would do. You know, I would go on Sunday. I'd go to play basketball. So anyway, but this poem, Avalanche, and I'm not going to read it all. And then, you know, I'm not going to read it all because we want to talk some. Comes out of the church in terms of the rhythm. Comes out of the church. Even though I left there, it stayed with me, you know. I don't know. Grace Bunbury was my first choir director. Grace Bunbury. She was my first choir director, you know. You know, she's a great opera singer now, but she was my first choir director. I used to hate her because she used to make us practice all the time. You know, Reverend Bracey, I hated him too. He was the minister, you know. But it was like, because he'd come by our house and eat all the best chicken up, you know. He'd eat all the best, the breasts and all the good parts. I hated him. I can say that now. You know what I mean? I really did dislike him. You know what I mean? But he didn't do nothing to me. He just was like that. So this poem called Avalanche, which is dedicated to K. Curtis Lyle and the memory of Richard Wright. K. Curtis Lyle is a good friend of mine. I was in the Watch Writers in Los Angeles, and he was one of the members of that group. It's called Avalanche. But it's based, for me, on the church. Within an avalanche of glory, hallelujah, sky breaks. Spraying syllables on the run, spreading sheets, waving holy sounds, solos sluicing African bound, transformed here in America from voodoo into hoodoo, inside tonguing blues, snaking horns, where juju grounds down sacred, up in cars, up in the gritty foo-foo, magical, where fleet rounds of cadences whirlpool as in rivers, where memory spins down foaming into dances like storm swallowed here in a burst of suns, up in the yeasting blue voodoo holding the secret clues, mum, inside the mystery unfolding, up in the caking dish rag of daybreak, miracles shaking out earthquakes of light like mojo hands luminous with spangling, and all the vamping blood songs of call and response. Yes, all the vamping blood songs of call and response, as in the pulpit when a preacher becomes his words, his rhythm those of a sacred blues man dead outside his door. Hit his gospel intersecting with antiphonal guitars, a congregation of amens, as in the slurred riffs, blue strings run back echoing themselves, answering the call, the voice cracked open like an egg, the yolk running out, the lungs imitating collapsed drums, and he is the rainbow and confluence of sacred tongues, the griot, the devotion of rivers, all up in his hands, all up in his fingers, his call, both invocation and quaking sermon, running true and holy as drumming cadences brewed in black church choirs. Glory, hallelujah, bows spreading from their mouths like wolfman's mojo, all up in Mahalia Jackson's lungs, howling vows rolled off hoodoo consonants, brewing magic, all up in the preacher's run of muddy water, strung all up in the farm, drenched with coal train, riffing all up in miles of Lightning Hopkins' mojo song, blues yeasting lungs of bird, when music is raised up as prayer and lives healing as June sun, quilted in the black baby's tongue, sewn deep in their lungs as power and blueprinted here in breath of rappers. So, now, you know, that poem is based in the, you know, coming out of the church. You know, and I just wanted to read that because I think it's important. And then there's a poem. I was St. Louis is right on the river. St. Louis is right on the river. And so this is a poem called Rivertown Packing House Blues. But St. Louis was a packing house town, okay? And a great poet, I dedicate this poem to Sterling Brown, who was one of my mentors. Sterling Brown was one of my mentors at Howard. And he loved this poem. He used to make me read it all the time, you know? And so it's based on the blues loosely. And I'll read a couple of stanzas and then I'll move on. Big Tom was a black nigger man, cold and black. I say Big Tom was a black nigger man, black steel flesh, standing like a gladiator, soaked in animal blood, bits of flesh wringing wet, standing at the center of death. Buzzards hovering, swinging his hammer called Death. 260 work days, swinging his hammer named Death. Big Tom was a black packing house man, 30 years. I say Big Tom was a black packing house man, loved them years, and swang his hammer like old John Henry, pounding nails, swang that hammer, 20 years, crushing skulls, cows and pigs, screaming fear, the man underneath slit their throats, 20 years, I say the man underneath slit their throats. Big Tom was apprenticed for 10 long years, watching death. I say, Tom was apprenticed for 10 long years, smelling death, was helping to a fight, fat white man who got slow. I say, was helping to a fat white man who swung a hammer till he couldn't do it no more. So he taught Big Tom how to kill with a hammer. I say, he taught Big Tom how to kill. And 20 years of killing is a lot to bring home. I say 20 years of killing is a lot to bring home. And drinking too much gin and whiskey can make a gentleman blow, don't you know? I say drinking too much gin and whiskey can make a good man sure enough blow, don't you know? Okay, that's the blues. And I'm going to read a couple more, and then I'm going to sit down, and we can have a conversation. I was a basketball player, and I always wanted to write a poem about basketball. I've only written two. One is a villanelle for Michael Jordan. But this was the first one. And I always wanted to kind of catch the rhythm of basketball on the floor. So I wrote this poem called Poem for Magic, and it's dedicated to Irving Magic Johnson and two people from St. Louis who played basketball with me. One is a big banker, Donnell Reed now, and Richard Franklin became a big architect. And so my mother knew where to find us. They knew where to find us. My mother did. So this poem is based a little bit, is a lot on jazz rhythms, you know, jazz rhythms. Take it to the hoop, Magic Johnson. Take the ball dazzling down the lane. Herk and jerk and raise your 6'9" frame into air, sweating screams of your neon name. Magic Johnson, nicknamed Windex way back in high school, cause you wiped glass backboard so clean. Where you first juked and shook, wild your way to glory, a new style fusion, shake and bake energy, using everything possible. You created your own space to fly through. Any moment now, we expect your wings to spread feathers for that spook take off of yours, then shake and glide right up in space till you hammer home a clothesline deuce off glass. Now come back down with a reverse hoodoo gem off the spin and stick it in swing, popping net clean from 20 feet right side. Put the ball on the floor again, Magic. Slide the dribble behind your back. Ease it deftly between your bony stalk legs, head bobbing ever which way up and down. You see everything on the court, off the high, yo-yo patter. Stop and go dribble. You thread a needle rope pass, sweet home to Kareem, cutting through the lane. His skyhook pops the cars. Now lead the fast break, hit worthy on the fly now. Blindside, a pinpoint, behind the back pass for two more, off the fake, looking the other way. You raise off balance into electric space, sweating chance of your name turn, 180 degrees off the move, your legs scissoring space, like a swimmer's yo-yoing motion in deep water, stretching out now toward free flight. You double pump, double pump, through trees, human trees, hang in place and slip the ball into your left hand, then deal it like Las Vegas car dealer off squared glass into nets, living up to your singular nickname. So bad, you caught with the crowd toward frenzy, wearing now your electric smile, neon as your name. And the last one and I have to say that this book is Oliver Jackson read this, so I want to end with this. Oliver Jackson read this poem. When I was going out to his house, and he read this poem. And he said, "Why, man, you got to do this and do that. You know, Oliver likes to take over shit, you know. Take over your stuff, you know. So I want to begin by reading that poem to him. This is called Ghost Voices. And this poem is a long poem. It's 75 pages, and in 13 parts. You know, 13 parts. Somebody said, "Man, 13 is the bad. You know, why'd you have 13 parts? You should have had 12." I said, "Shut up." You know, I don't believe in all that shit, man. 13 is bad. You know, ride on the elevator, black cat is bad. It's a whole lot of stuff that's bad. You know what I mean? So I'm gonna make it 13 parts anyhow. So this is a poem. I'm not going to read it. I'm going to read some of it, because in this poem, We're talking about in creating new farms. And in this poem, I create the 7-Elevens. The 7-Elevens, you know, seven lines and 11 lines. And you start out with a seven lines, 7-Eleven, 7-Eleven, 7-Eleven. And it goes down for seven lines. And then you do the 11s, 11 lines, seven lines like that, and you go for 11 lines. And it's based on the throw of the dice. You know, 7-Eleven, you win. Snake Eyes, you lose. I'm talking about this, and I never gamble. But I saw it. I used to watch it growing up, people gambling. And so this is why. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to read the last few ones, and you can get an idea. Deep in new world vocabularies, galvanizing power in our invented forms here, now on display in the creative forces we move through as blackamoors, move into our unknown future. We renew our fecund imagination, impregnating the language found in our voices. We are breaking through linguistic paralysis, raising up magic, mystery in this moment with poets creating new poetic forms. 7-Eleven wins the game of dice. 7-Eleven wins, free of terror. We are here, reborn. We breathe in the moment, creating, speaking the future in song, unafraid of madness of the past. We are syncopating Duke's magic. The train whistle rambunctiousness of Basie's inventive driving music, the voodoo lace trumpet voice of Shango riffs, nailing Satchmo's gumbo voice, the Kansas City rooster sound of Bird's hot pepper, soaring solo horn, shooting white girl, nodding sickness through his veins, a sign of the times to come, speaking through Bud Powell's catatonic words, though one can see in his eyes, genius slant of notes, riffs run off blurring wings of his hummingbird fingers, flying over piano keys, tickling cards. 7-Eleven wins the game of dice. 7-Eleven wins. High priest of hypnosis, monk, block carding mysteriosos, black and white keys, shuffling his feet back and forth. Under the piano, the fleet flying, high flying, rat-tat-tat speedo, brass licks, dizzy blows, spitting bebop with Cuban flash up in his attitude. The president of hipness, wearing a badge, saying hivey-divey sweet, jamming soul, blending melody, syllables blown, wailing through saxophone speak, bop cool, as the prince of darkness style, too hip for clues, to express through metaphors, so he whispers, muted kind of blue trumpet, licks, creating new language in music, five times, so-called cool jazz, roadhouse, funk, rock and roll, bitches brew on the corner with those hip, deep, bass, drum, grooves, 7-Eleven wins the game of life. 7-Eleven wins. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. You did a great job of timing out there. And that leaves us some time for question and answer for those of you who want to stay. If you need to go, I understand. So, you know, I just want to say to begin with that it's very special to witness this kind of coming together, and we get to be part of it. I'm really a spectator, but to have Paul coming from Panama, Quincy coming from New York, Oliver coming from Oakland, Donald coming from St. Louis, other people coming from all over is wonderful. We're very honored to have you here. Maybe I'll just throw something out and then we'll open it up. But I wanted you open it up. You're the director. You take that microphone.
I want you to explicate that idea about the rhythms in Dogon AD that you explained to me earlier, which I had never spoken to. It might be interesting for you talking.
Well, can we do it in the way he's going to ask questions, then you can do it.
No, I'm going to let him ask.
This is from before. We were listening to Dogon AD, the Julius Hemphill album, and I was saying I believe that the title song is written in 11-8. There's 11 beats in every measure, and here we come with 7 and 11 from Quincy, and that's very interesting. Nice way of rounding things out with such a non non-Western number to deal with there. There's so many connections. I mean, you both talked about creating space, I guess, for improvisation and ritual and channeling African feeling and sources, sensibility, if you want, in very different art forms. You have several art forms between you. What did the two of you hear listening to one another that resonated as a common heritage?
It was very interesting to hear Quincy, we didn't rehearse this, and to hear him speak about something that apparently has been on the minds of a lot of black artists. There's a certain synergy, no matter what the particular discipline you're working in, painting, poetry, theater, music, there is a certain synergy in terms of what the artists are trying to do, including Miles, including Oliver Jackson, including certainly myself. So in other words, it was nice to hear his piece against what I was trying to elaborate on. In other words, it's not, this is painting and this is that, this is the other. The processing of the ideas come through the same kind of sensibilities.
No, I think it all, for me, comes together, and like Paul said, and is synergistic. And synergistic, I love, I go into people's painters' studios and buy paintings. And because I feel them close to me. I like to live in my apartment with artwork. And anybody who's been to my apartment knows that. You know, I like to look at it every day. I look at it every day. You know what I mean? I got it in my office where I work. And I listen to music. You know, I just don't listen to African American. I listen to great music. Yeah, I think I like great music. It could be Beethoven, it could be Bach, it could be Miles, it could be Charlie Parker, it could be Prince. You know, it could be Stevie Wonder, it could be Michael Jackson. You come in my house, you could hear anything. You know what I mean? Anything that's I think is important for me. You know, so, or somebody talking. You know, Richard Pryor. You know, I mean, they have that. That thing that I need to feed my imagination, you know, like I like when I hear Sting, you know, or if I hear Bono, you know, I hear that music, the Welsh music. I mean, you know, it could be anything, because I think, like Miles said, I believe that music is music, you know, and it's gonna be. He says, great music or bad music. You know, he reject bad music. He didn't want to listen. He couldn't, you know. And so I that's the way I feel about it, you know, about art. When I come, you know, when I go someplace or a play, I go to plays. One of the things I don't like sometimes about plays, I like to sit on the, and this happened because of my Mary Baraka. Because I used to always go to plays and see Mary Baraka would always sit on the end, in the back. In the back, the seat on the end, right by the go out, till you can go out. So I said, why are you always sitting in the back? He said, so I can leave. So I can leave. If it's bad, I can leave. And I used to do that too, you know. You know, you don't want to be sitting in the middle like that. It's packed. You can't get up, you know. You know. So the synergy, I think, is really, for me, is really important. I know it's a long-winded answer, but.
That's great. Thank you. I'll just make one other little point and open it up. But one thing that struck me and hearing both of you is that, and maybe Quincy in particular, when you were talking about the European forms that you can manipulate, but really wanting to do something coming out of the United States.
Yes.
And and that axis is a different axis than the axis of Africa and America. Mm-hmm. And I wonder how you see those two axes working together for both of you. I mean, you're both interested in African forms, in European forms, and yet wanting to do something that's in some way American.
I would say, first of all, the question is how, like Oliver's statement earlier in the interview in Spain, you're not trying to use Africa as a specific pathway toward the works that are being created here, no more so than if you're living in the Caribbean, you don't look to American blacks for that path. It's all pretty much contextualized by your experience. But what you do have in common, or we all have in common, is the African continuum. The sensibility remains, given articulation through certain kinds of social and sacred activities in our communities, not one mocking the other. It becomes very peculiar to that particular one, but the sensibilities, how you form the ideas, how you bring shape to music, how you think, how you do oratory. All of these things are African in terms of not conscious thinking about it. I'm now behaving like an African. Like, you cannot dress up Africa either. You know, somebody puts on a dashiki doesn't make him African.
Right.
That's simply, you know, the sense burlesquing. So it's not the thing is, the idea is that to find the kinds of spaces that allow you to let that flow through you without it being cut off by the practices of, even though we're living in America, many of the practices are antithetical to the ways that we find ideas. You know, I mean, for example, the rationalism you know, as opposed to spiritualism. Those are different kinds of experiences. And so that a person who is of color in the Caribbean, in South America, or here, through their own cultural context, find Africa in it without ever thinking about it. Mm-hmm. That's the point.
Yeah, and I would say, yeah. You know, I think that I've always wanted to get to the point, because I lived in Africa for a period of time, and I taught there in Ghana and in Lagos, in Nigeria. And by the time I came back, I had absorbed a lot of stuff because of the fact that I was living there, living with the people, eating with them, you know, and eating the foods that they ate, and coming back. And when I came back, and, you know, it was a part of the way I was, in a way. And so I agreed that, you know, it's not enough to wear a dashiki. You know, some people wear dashikis, and they call, hey, brother, what's happening? You know, and they think they're African. You know what I mean? I mean, like, what? You want to eat this fufu? What? What is that? Fufu. No, with your hands. No, I can't. No, no, no. But he got a dashiki on. You know, and he got, you know what I'm saying? He got a dashiki and all the stuff, but he ain't going to do that. He ain't going to go eat the food like that. You know, oh, that smells bad, you know? You know, but so that's what I'm saying. So I'm saying that you have to absorb it and not just put on something and say that you think you are. And but, you know, it's like I know just living there and living every day, I think that what we have to do, and I wanted to just say this before we get through talking, I think Americans have to recognize what being an American is. Most people don't understand what it is to be this country, to be out of this country. This is a multicultural, multi-religious, multi-ethnic country. You know what I mean? It is. And so people, you can't run away from it. You just can't run away from it. You can't run away from the fact that Elvis Presley was influenced by African-American music. You just can't. But you listen to Elvis Presley, but you don't want to listen to no black music. You don't want to acknowledge that. But you listen to Elvis Presley or Johnny Cash or whoever. You know what I'm saying?
And
so it's like people have to they have to grow up and get a little hipper, you know, about stuff.
I think this is time for this is an applause line, everybody. This is an applause line, man.
You know?
Yeah, I think so.
You know, I mean, they do. You know, and
thank you.
You know, I mean, that's what it is. I mean, they. I noticed that people, you know, I mean, it's just got to get. They have to understand that they are a part. We are all this thing together, And if it sinks, it's going to be because we don't do things together. If it goes down, that's why it's going to go down. Not because I did something, but because the whole collectively, we didn't do it together. You know, and that, and we have to do that. We have to get to that point where when we're thinking about playwrights, we have to think about Paul Carter Harrison. Or we think about poetry, we have to think about me. Or paintings, we have to think about Oliver Jackson. Or, you know, you have to think about it. It's not just, I look at art books, and it's always, they have in there all the white painters. So I'm looking like, why ain't Oliver Jackson in that book? Why isn't he in that magazine? You know, why aren't these painters in there, or poets, or, you know, these, when they talk about stuff? They don't. They just don't do it. You know, they can't, they're blocked. You know, so yet they have to get away from being blocked, you know, in a lot of ways. I mean, all of us have to do that, and so.
That's why we're all here. Questions? Comments? Yes.
So I think in the middle of the 20th century, there was a particular movement amongst African people to start a redefinition of self and a re-identification with Africanness. But very often we don't see that same, or we don't look for that same change in the African milieu itself. So the modality of Africanness has changed for folks on the continent. Now, you all have all been to Africa and studied with Africans and whatnot, but that is just something that I would postulate has woven itself into artistic expression. So in your poetry, you see the rhythmic changes here in basketball or in the expressions of cultural Americanness. And then in the paintings and in the other literary works, musical works, you see a change in expressions of African rhythms and African thoughts and modalities. So I guess I'm expressing that this change has woven itself into Africans around the globe. It's not just the one-sided African American or the Western versus old world Africa modal concepts. What would you say about that?
I'm not altogether, I'm caught in between a statement and a question, so I'm not entirely sure what you're suggesting, but as I said earlier, each of the thing that qualifies what we as African diasporic people do is contextualized by our particular experience. But inside of that experience, you will find traces or remnants of Africa, the old country, as it were, filtering through that particularized experience. And so that how to produce a song or a poem or a dance, you'll find those elements from Africa in it without looking backward and saying, how did you do that and trying to replicate it? It just comes forward. I mean, Aretha Franklin did not have to go to Africa to become Aretha Franklin. It comes out of this particular experience, but it is definitely inside of the African mode of sonority. So I don't think of myself as an African Caribbean person, African American person, but very definitely African. You see, the first thing I start from is I am African, born and raised in this country as an American. I've been acculturated a certain kind of way, responded to certain kinds of social experiences that filter, that the Africanness has to filter through that. See, if it makes sense to you. So that if a person is in Suriname, which is also a multicultural place, but in a multicultural from driving force there is the African part, so that the people from Indonesia all from other, Netherlands, flow through that and create a whole kind of way of practice, social practice, and aesthetic possibilities within that. But if you trace it back, you are the outside person, you will find it's all contiguous with something that's been retained from the African sensibility.
Your old friend there, Oliver Jackson, is eager to say something.
Oliver's good at this.
He's eager to say something within a 5-minute time frame.
The reason we're having this discussion about an African sensibility or African people is because this country has denied African people. There'd be absolutely no need for this if, in fact, we had not been denied it in every way. So it was the artists and the musicians literally driven by a sensibility that's obvious to everybody in the United States who African people are, regardless of whether we're in Africa or not, it's the black people in the country. It's like the Chinese. Come on. The sensibility of the Chinese, and they were enslaved, did not create in the same objective way that we do. What makes it clear is the sensibility all over the world that this is black, using a term that's put on us. You go to Africa and say you're black, that's ridiculous. So this is a term that we have to defend here, and it's crucial that we defend it because we have been belabored and beat to death with our own. So everybody is jiving, and so it forces the artists to have to pick up what they shouldn't have to. The driving force behind all people's creation is their sensibility. You can take the Europeans and put them in the United States, and this is a Eurocentric thrust, aesthetic thrust. There's nothing wrong with it. It's just that it tries to blank out all other thrusts. So we're here trying to defend what is obvious. Hip-hop is obviously from an African sensibility. It's obvious. Caribbean music, get out of here.
Yeah.
The Europeans are there. They didn't do that. So people, why do we BS all this? Sensibility is what drives all human beings. You can take the Chinese and keep them here for years, and this Chinese sensibility will not die. The Europeans can leave Europe. The European sensibility will not die. Chief Joseph says, you can kill us, but our spirit will be here. This is the most definite way of saying something that is difficult to identify specifically, but shows itself objectively by what it is you make. You use the world. Everybody uses the world.
I think that's a pretty good note to end on. I want to thank everybody very, very much, and thank Quincy Troupe, Paul Carter Harrison, all of you. Thank you so much.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.